Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome Good morning. To the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julian Polly live in the studio as well. If you're listening on Catch Up, it is Bank Holiday Saturday, the 29th of August. And a rather wet bank holiday as well.
It's going to in a bit.
It's going to in a bit, I think. Yes. More of the same. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking to RPG. And we've also got a guest speaker this week, and indeed, whenever there are 5 Saturdays in the month, Phil Muffett from the Mex Britain Swinton Astronomical Society comes to speak to us. He'll also be speaking to us next Saturday as well, where he does a general roundup on Eye in the Sky. All being well this week, though, we'll be covering the partial solar eclipse, the Perseid meteor shower, and the Solar Sunday event last week at RSPB Oldmoor. He might even be able to tell us about a bit of filming that's been happening, which is at the minute top secret until it's broadcast. How exciting. they're going from strength to strength, the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society. You can check them out on msas.org.uk. First up in the news, though, Paul?
First, we must apologise for last week. There was a big problem.
Missing podcast. We were broadcasting, unfortunately. The system... Wasn't playing, so we lost the podcast.
Something back on.
So our Chris will be coming back in the future to cover that story again about Italy and obesity.
Yes.
But next up, this week.
Yes, more than 68,000 men get prostate cancer a year. The number of men living with prostate cancer in the UK has surged by 100,000 since 2020, a charity has said. Macmillan Cancer Support said more than 68,000 men were newly diagnosed in the UK each year, the equivalent of one new diagnosis every 8 minutes. The charity's latest estimates show there are now around 600,000 men living with prostate cancer in the UK, compared with 500,000 in 2020. Macmillan said prostate cancer was the most common type of cancer diagnosed in the UK. The charity has warned that myths surrounding the disease could be preventing men from getting checked. Dr. Anthony Cunliffe. Its lead medical advisor said, one of the biggest misunderstandings I hear is that feeling well means you cannot have prostate cancer. Many people are surprised to learn that in reality, prostate cancer often develops without symptoms in its early stages, which is why it is important to have a conversation with your GP if you're worried. The charity said some men with the disease would not notice symptoms for many years, and that symptoms usually occurred only when the cancer was large enough to press on the urethra, the tube which passes urine. When symptoms occur, they include difficulty urinating, needing to urinate more often than usual, especially at night, a feeling that the bladder has not been completely emptied, and an urgency when needing the toilet, blood in urine, blood in semen. McMillan said it was important for men to speak to their GP if they experience any of these symptoms.
Yeah, all good advice there. Yes. Next up, a secure facility in Warwickshire. There were about 14,000 vegetable seed samples being preserved and cultivated, basically a living library of potential crops. The UK Vegetable Gene Bank is the facility that could play a crucial role in food security as climate change intensifies. And on that note, there was a very interesting article in last Saturday's Times. It's written by Adam Vaughan, their environment editor, and it's titled Biggest El Nino Brings Drought and Storms. So the El Nino weather phenomenon this year is set to be an unprecedented super event. The Met Office said that the cycle which influences weather and food prices around the world would be the most powerful on record. To be fair, they've been warning about that for a while now. So what is El Nino? The El Nino Southern Oscillation Cycle is a climate pattern driven by the tropical Pacific Ocean and the atmosphere. When it is neutral, trade winds blow from east to west and colder water is drawn upwards along the west coast of South America. It becomes an El Nino, which is Spanish for the boy, when winds weaken or reverse, allowing warmer water back towards South America. So how strong will it be? Well, the strength of an El Nino is measured by how much warmer than usual temperatures are in a thin strip of the Pacific Ocean's surface between 5 degrees north and 5 degrees south. An anomaly of 0.5 degrees Celsius or more is the threshold for an El Nino. Above 2 degrees Celsius is very strong. This El Nino coming this year should be well above 3 degrees Celsius and potentially almost 4 degrees Celsius. So what does all that mean for the UK then? It may increase the chances of wetter, stormy conditions from October to December. Some might say we're starting to see that already after a very, very dry summer. We've had torrential rain over the last few days. Well, large El Nino events create a wave train of low-pressure systems across the North Atlantic that land directly over the UK. And that's according to Nick Dunstan, who's a science fellow at the Met Office. So what about the rest of the world then? Well, Central America and northern parts of South America will be dry and severe droughts are likely. Indonesia, the Philippines and India will also be dry. Other areas including Mexico, the southwestern US, the Horn of Africa and Southern America, including parts of Brazil, Uruguay and Paraguay, will have more risk of flooding. So what about global temperatures then? Well, the article said next year will almost certainly be the hottest on record. Historically, a 1 degree Celsius El Nino corresponds to a 0.1 degree Celsius change in the global average temperature. So this episode could add about 0.3 degrees Celsius next year, and that's according to Zeke Hausfather, a climate scientist at Berkeley Earth, which is an American research institute. So does climate change affect it? Well, researchers are studying whether climate change is making El Nino episodes more frequent and intense. What is clear, according to Nick Dunstan, who's the science fellow at the Met Office, he says is the effects of El Nino were exacerbated by climate change. And what about the economic effects and impacts then? Dry conditions in Central America have already left the Panama Canal struggling with drought, affecting global shipping. Analysis by the International Monetary Fund has shown that a typical El Nino increases global food prices by 5% over a year. So how have past events been then? Well, big El Nino years such as 1998, 2016 and 2024, so not that long ago, set records for global average temperatures. The last one in 2024 led to Southern Africans' worst drought in more than a century. So how long will El Nino last? Well, this year is expected to peak in November or December, and El Nino episodes typically last between 9 and 12 months. So a summary there of an article by Adam Vaughan in the Saturday Times last week. How does the El Nino work then? He describes it as, in normal conditions, trade winds blow to the west along the equator from South America towards Asia. But when you get an El Nino condition, trade winds relax in the central and western Pacific, leading to a flattening of the thermocline. Rainfall follows the warm water eastward, with associated flooding in Peru and drought in Indonesia. Expect wetter and stormier weather in the UK. Blimey.
Stormy weather at 57 Mount Pleasant Street. Well, it's the same room, but everything's different. You can fight the sleep, but not the dream. Things ain't cooking in my kitchen. Strange affliction wash over. And the Roman Empire couldn't conquer the blue sky. Well, there's a small boat made of China. It's going nowhere on the mantelpiece. Do I lie like a lounge room lizard, or do I sing like a bird released? Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, always take the weather. Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, always take the weather.
Track there. Weather With You by Crowded House. We're talking about the biggest El Nino bringing drought and storms, particularly the storms and wet weather to us this year in the UK. Of course, listen to the Lab Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Lab 93.2 FM. I can't seem to get hold of RPG. So very briefly, I'll mention, before our Phil comes on about 11:30 or so, RSPB, Batwalk and Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society Night Sky event, and that's going to happen on Friday the 18th of September 2026 from about 4:30 in the afternoon till 7 p.m. The venue is the RSPB Old Maud Reserve, and the tickets are priced between £9 and £19 depending whether you're a child, an adult, or whether you're a member or a non-member. And what's the event all about? Well, join the team at Old Maud and Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society for an evening of natural spectacle. Come on a guided walk to see the birds coming into roost at sunset, and then as the skies darken, lift your gaze skywards as the stars come out. The evening will start with a choice of guided walk to our hides to watch the wonderful wildflower come into roost. You may even see the barn owls return to their nests, or even elusive bitterns settling down in reed beds. Following the walks, Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society will be on hand to show you the wonders of the night sky through their powerful telescopes. In the classroom will be an amazing presentation of film footage of the stars. Meanwhile, in the visitor centre, there will be a demonstration of a planetarium to show you the wider planetary systems. And up in the RSBB cafe, Supernaut drinks will be available to warm you up. Little snippet there from War War Galaxy Number 1 by Bill Nelson. Bit more of that later, all being well. Listen to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. RPG should be on the line. Good morning, PG. Oh, oh, you're sounding a bit faint.
Oh, sorry about that.
Well, no, we're back. We're back because we're on Paul's phone. All the things are sent to try us, Paul. Oh, I think it's this wire now. Are you there still?
Hello.
Yeah. We're fine. What's caught your eye in the science news this week, then, Paul?
Well, I think there's a danger sometimes when you're digging through the mounds and mounds of world of talking rubbish or even talking a load of pants, but let's dig into it and see what we can find. I think news this week of the removal of the everybody's been talking about, and a clean-up at Kidlington, which involved the removal of 22,000 tonnes of waste, and it cost £6 million. So this is illegal dumping of waste. We've seen several examples. They say that the government is going to try and recover these costs from the criminals responsible. So it'll be an interesting thing to see. But it sort of highlights the issues with waste and how we get rid of it. I think we talked in the past about the problems of handling nuclear waste and sealing it in ceramic or other things and burying it deep underground. So if you look at waste removal, then a few things cropped forward in science in recent week. You've got the problem of the waste on the ground, but when it comes to the buried waste, then Michael Sheen had a very interesting documentary on the BBC talking about the toxic waste that's been dumped all over Wales. And basically what he was saying is that he welcomed the reaction to his documentary, where he investigated Wales' toxic waste legacy. And dozens of people contacted BBC Wales following that programme to tell them of other things that had happened. But he said it's actually, Sheen started to investigate the workings of a chemical giant, Monsanto, and the dumping of polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, which we talked about in the past. And one of these people was a former worker with the company, and he spent 3 years helping to seal toxic waste underground, and said staff had cheap protective equipment and weren't really told what they were burying. The Eastman Chemical Company, which is responsible for Monsanto's legacy production in the UK, didn't respond to Sheen or the team at the BBC when asked for comment. So getting a response was a really important part of it. And they said that they had some extraordinary messages from people who wanted to tell their stories and how they'd been affected. And said there's a lot of stuff to be followed up from this, but I think it's an indicator that we do have a problem with waste and the removal of waste. So we can see it visually on the surface where these people illegally start to have dumps. And they're pretty much a lot of the time alongside a main road with some tree cover between the road and the dumping site. But to actually manage to dump 22,000 tonnes of waste, as this first site that's cleared, takes a lot of doing. So realistically, how is it not being noticed? Because I think most of us, if you see a lorry full of waste, don't immediately think, where's that going? You just think, gosh, look at that size of that lorry full of waste going somewhere. Mm. Well, it can go to above ground, but it can also go underground. And I know locally, where I used to live on Freshville, there was a dump site there, and we were surprised when all of a sudden these funnels appeared around the edge of the site, and they were burning off the methane gas. Because the thing with a modern dump site is that they're compacting the rubbish and putting layers of soil over it, and it starts to basically ferment and produce things like methane gas. You need to flare that off. Often in the evening you could see a flame coming from these funnels as the methane gas was burnt. And I think that a lot of time nowadays, these dump sites can be used for a long time, filled over, and then there's supposed to be a time limit, I think, on when you can actually make further use of the ground that's there, because the rate that the rubbish decomposes will sort of show the strength of that ground to support things like building housing on, which is one of the things. And quite often we find that with the reclamation of industrial sites. Once they've been reclaimed, the problem is quite often they have a highly toxic sort of signature coming from the industrial use that's there. And it's a very expensive removal issue to clear the soil that's contaminated. It can build up to be quite a problem. So I think the documentary from Michael Sheen is something which is to be applauded for. Someone had told him the story of this stuff being deposited. And I think there are sites well distributed around Wales, but also some that creep over into England as well. I think that our dealing with waste is one of those things. It's a bit like a lot of things now. It's not particularly well policed in a lot of respects. And the problem is now that a lot of local sites that are under local authority control are policed and start to either ask for a payment for removal of your waste or other things. And a lot of that contributes to people going and illegally dumping their waste somewhere else. So I think we need a bit more of a grown-up approach to waste disposal. And hopefully then we can try and stop these criminal activities where huge waste dumps are made. And say the cost to the taxpayer on shifting 22,000 tonnes of this was £6 million. So it's not cheap. And people who live nearby, I mean, we have a dump in Attercliffe in Sheffield, which has been going on for many years now. It's still not being cleared, and the local people are complaining about the attraction for vermin, so rats are appearing, the smell that's coming from it, and it really is a case of, well, it's been there and it's grown over the years, and nobody's been able to control it, even though complaints have been lodged with whoever people can think might have something to do with it. So a load of rubbish, I guess, is what it's all about. The other thing, I think, things can be seen as pants sometimes when you're looking into things, and an intriguing story which is to do with pants. So this is scientists in the University of Zurich, and they had citizen scientists, 1,000 people, and they asked them to bury their underwear.
Oh, brilliant.
So more than 1,000 volunteers buried cotton underwear across Switzerland. And the whole point of it is to help scientists measure how active the different soils were. So the faster the fabric disappeared, the more biological activity was taking place underground. And gardens showed the fastest decomposition, while lawns had the least. And that reveals how strongly land management can shape soil life. So and they say that soil supports the food we eat, stores water, carbon and nutrients, and provides habitat for an enormous share of life on Earth. Scientists estimate that more than half of global biodiversity exists below the surface. So soil biodiversity is declining around the world. And again, we've mentioned this, that the soil quality around the world seems to be suffering. And that's threatening agriculture, food security, and the ability of ecosystems to function properly. So to investigate it, the researchers from the University of Zurich and Agriscope, that's the Swiss Federal Centre for Excellence for Agricultural Research, launched this citizen science project in 2021. And it was designed to both raise awareness of soil ecosystems and generate scientific data. So they followed the same standardized method with 1,000 volunteers who buried more than 2,000 pairs of cotton underwear and 12,000 tea bags, which again we've touched on before about how disposable tea bags are, over across 1,000 sites all across Switzerland. And after 2 months, the participants dug them up, photographed them, and sent the material to the laboratory along with soil samples for further study. And through all this activity, the findings were published in Plants, People, Planet, which is a magazine output, and produced a broad map of the biological activity in Swiss soils. So they found that cotton underwear broke down at very different speeds depending on where it was buried. and that decomposition rate served as a simple indicator to how much biological activity was taking place underground. So when soil organisms were more active, they broke down the cotton more quickly. Private gardens showed the fastest decomposition. So researchers also found that these soils contain the highest amounts of organic matter, creating favourable conditions for earthworms, fungi, bacteria and other organisms that live in the soil. And lawns showed the least level of soil organism activity, and agricultural fields and meadows ranked between the two, gardens and lawns. So their results, they say, show how the soil is managed can significantly affect both the soil life and soil quality. And that's from the study leader, or co-leader of the study, Marcel van der Heijden, who's a professor of agroecology. And the researchers point to several practices that can encourage soil life. These include keeping soil permanently covered, applying compost, using more diverse crop rotation, and reducing minerals, fertilizer. So the factors studied, they had things like the land use had the strongest influence on how quickly the underwear decomposed, and whether a location was a garden, meadow or cultivated field or lawn explained the differences in the decomposition. The chemical properties also mattered. Nutrient levels, for example, were a significant effect on how active soil was. And the rapid breakdown of the underwear was often associated with very fertile soil and a plentiful supply of nutrients. And for agricultural land, these conditions can be beneficial because they support the plant production. So might sound a load of pants, but it's a serious science experiment, and it's a good indicator with condition of soil. I know University of Sheffield, we've covered several things where they've looked at soil quality and ways to develop the soil. Some of that is ground up granite chips that are spread on the soil that have got a slow nutrient release possibility. They're also looking, you mentioned I think about droughts, the problems of drought can also be a sort of condition indicator for the soil. So, I think we've all seen in the news that changing temperatures, as you touched on, can have a very big effect. And we've seen the terrible landslide that set about a catastrophe in Nepal. And the border with Tibet, and that's really glaciers that are starting to melt, and as they melt they can affect the solidity of the surrounding soil. So a collapse in that is at the heart of the problem, I think, in Nepal. So a lot of pants, a lot of rubbish.
But you've chosen a great track, though.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was on the surface, but I think a lot of rubbish has been going underground.
Very good, Paul. Ooh.
So I'm not getting myself in a jam. I'll let you play the music.
Brilliant, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday. Claudia's Rock Show 1 till 3. Bye-bye. Bye-bye,
bye-bye
Paul.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Might say that I should strive for more, but I'm so happy I can't see the same things happening here today. A show of strength with your boys' brigade, and I'm so happy and you're so kind. You want more money, of course I don't mind. To buy nuclear tanks, push for atomic rhymes, and the public gets what the public wants. But I want nothing, society's got. I'm going underground,
going underground.
What if the brass bands play up? Tomorrow. Some people might
enough already on my plate. People might need some tension to relax me. I'm too busy dodging between the flags. You see, here's what you get. You've made your bed, you better lie in it. You choose your leaders and place your trust. As their lies will shut down and their promises rust. Using killing machines with paper rockets and guns. And the public wants what the public gets. But I don't give what the society wants. I'm going underground. Till my head explodes. I turn on the news and my body froze. It's playing sheep on my TV screen. But this boy shout, but this boy scream. Going underground. Going underground. Going underground. I'm going underground.
Going underground, RPG was talking about dumping of waste, illegally as well, going underground, great stuff. Listen to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Phil Muffet on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Oh, hang on. Let me have a listen. You're in the summer house, aren't you?
Yes.
Not under the stairs. But now we've got a problem.
Too much noise.
I know. Well, we've got a problem now this end because our where we plug you into, Phil, so to speak, he's been playing up for us, but no, you're there, you're loud and clear, I think.
It's nice to be plugged in.
One side only.
Yeah, we've got one side only. I'll just have to tamper with it a bit, Phil. Anyway, for people who don't know who you are, Phil, you are a member of the Mexico and Swinton Astronomical Society.
Yes,
and going from strength to strength, there's so much to talk about, Phil. Where shall we start?
Oh, wherever.
Go on, let's start on Wednesday the 12th of August. When, unbeknown to you and your club, a load of people descended upon your observatory.
Yeah, we had two people on Facebook ask if they could come up and have a look through the telescope at the observatory. And we responded by saying, yes, of course you can. We're up there from like 6 o'clock onwards. So a couple of our members we knew were going up, but they got their camera gear and telescopes. Most of our tribe was in Spain on holiday in the totality zone. And that left a handful of us back at home. So when me and Glenn Marsden turned up at 6 o'clock at the observatory, the lane was full of cars.
Wow.
We couldn't get into his car park and we had to park up near Hoover Stand, and there were about 150 people.
Wow.
So not quite as bad as Doncaster, though, because they had about 1,500 people turn up. They had an advert on the tea time Yorkshire TV, and they had about 1,500 people turn up, and I think then they started turning people away, and there was only 4 committee members to look after. So it was they had a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah,
so we managed to marshal our audience, but to be honest, it kind of distracted us from what we wanted to do.
Yeah, but this is the price of fame, Phil. You've made it. You see, you want people to be interested in astronomy, all of a sudden they are, because it was a once-in-a-lifetime event, that eclipse, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. That's true. I mean, there's eclipses nearly every year, but they're usually partial and they're all over the world. And some places like Arctic or Antarctic, there's only certain people can actually get there to see them. And then you get other strange places in the middle of nowhere, I don't know, across middle of Africa or middle of Central America, or out over the Pacific Ocean or in the Atlantic, and it's really difficult to see. So when they are overland and they are good, it is. I don't want to say a rarity, but it is difficult to see, yes, for the average person, definitely.
And for you, for them to go to your club or to Doncaster's, yeah, it's a safe way for people to do it, because the day after there was, yes, no end of stories in the press about people problems with their eyes because they've been looking at the sun with the wrong equipment.
It's hard to imagine people have been doing this. Every time we do a talk anywhere, we always say never look at the sun. You've got to have special equipment. It's not cheap, and yeah, only do it in certain ways, and you can't just look through a telescope or binocular, or even with your eyes. You can partially blind yourself just looking at the sun. It's a special technique. There's also things like shadows and using pinhole cameras, and everybody on TV and social media had put out ways of observing the sun without looking at it. And, of course, good old British public.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I feel sorry for people that have done it wrong, but the information's out there to do it right.
Yeah. And people were selling out of colanders and things, weren't they?
I tell you what, two teenagers turned up with a breakfast box and they cut a hole in it. And he says, and this kid said, he says, we can't get this to work. So I got a piece of tape, taped it over his hole and put a pinhole in it.
Yes.
So that it could hold it up and the sun shone on the back of his breakfast box, in the bottom of his box, and you could see the eclipse in a breakfast box.
Wow.
Using the pinhole camera technique. It was absolutely fine. So fortunately, we got the gear. Meanwhile, we weren't watching the eclipse. So when we turned up, Roy had tried to get the scope working on his own and he couldn't get it all working. Me and Glenn turned up at 6 o'clock, so we sprung into action. Roy had got the YouTube on in the lecture room, so we could actually see the eclipse from different cameras around the world, which was interesting. Meanwhile, it took us about 15 minutes to get the telescope in operation, get the dome open and get the sun into view. And we've got a H-alpha filter on our large telescope. So I managed to look at the sun about 10 minutes into the eclipse. So I missed the start. So then we were marshalling people in and out of the building. So we got 10 people upstairs, 10 people in our lecture room, so they could see the sun eclipse via YouTube, different parts of Spain. It started off in Iceland. Well, it was cloudy in Iceland, so they didn't see the actual eclipse. And I think it was in Reykjavik, the camera crew, so they just had a dark, cloudy sky. But when it was in Spain, they had some good views. And then basically we were marshalling people. When they looked through the telescope, they were outside, and then we brought the next group up from downstairs into the observatory. So we were continuously rotating people around. Anyway, I'd got my own filter that I'd made, and I managed to take a photograph of the sun at maximum through my filter and camera. I got a nice photo, but I didn't manage to take another photograph through the telescope. And then I didn't manage to see it until after it had come out. Well, we didn't see it again because we were showing everybody what was happening. So, yeah, so while I did see it, it wasn't a spectacle for me because I was looking after people along with Glenn.
But that's just amazing, though. Yeah. So how many of those people came along were absolutely mesmerised and thought,
We had a couple of people give us some really good remarks. And an old lady, a grandma, said she brought her two grandsons up, and she said she was thoroughly impressed and amazed and how wonderful it all was. So to be honest, that was worth a comment, to be honest.
Yeah, so I presume you've got a lot more new followers now on Facebook and Instagram and your website and everything.
Yeah, I believe we have. So, yeah, I just wish we could get a few more members out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but social media's doing its job, isn't it? But, you know, you're only a small club, aren't you? It's the price of fame, you know. You can't have 150 people rocking
up. Yeah, yeah. To be honest, our club's got about 40 members, and it's a nice number. We'd like a few more. But what we're really concerned about is, and we've talked to other people about this, and it's happening all over the country, there isn't enough of the younger generation joining any clubs.
No.
And the problem is, in fact, there was, I noticed on the TV last night, there's been trouble in Middlesbrough after the road accident they had with the police and the people in the car. And then they had a bit of a do, and they were interviewing this councillor in Middlesbrough, and they were saying there's nothing for young kids to do.
No.
Keep them occupied. Well, there is. There's clubs that can join, and there's things that can do, just like our astronomy club. There's all kinds of clubs out there that are desperate for people to join, because if people aren't in clubs, part of society will die.
Yeah, yeah. It's a shared thing. It's a somewhere to go and to mix with people and share your knowledge and
people.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing is, you can borrow equipment. We have equipment we lend out to people as well, and we're going to sponsor a student as well this year. So somebody's going to university, and we're going to sponsor them with some equipment so they can do the degree.
Brilliant.
So there's all that kind of stuff. There's loads of spin-offs from being in a club. And other thing is, you can get places that you can't get as an individual.
Yeah. So you were saying that evening, you told us that not only would have the partial solar eclipse, you'd have the Percy meteor shower, but you said you were so tired.
By the time we packed up, it was 9 o'clock, and I needed a pint, and I needed something to eat as well.
Oh, dear.
And it was still a bit of daylight left, so we went to the Marquis and had a drink to eat. But when I came home, I did have an hour in the back garden. I did see a Percy meteorite from the back garden on my deck chair while I was having another pint. And some of the members did see a few, but to be honest, I don't know what it was. From an urban environment, they are hard to see, but you do see the brighter ones. But I've got quite a few trees and lights around my back garden, so it's not an ideal place to watch for meteorites, but apparently it was quite a good shower.
Brilliant. So what about all your members that, instead of helping you up at your observatory and all that, when everybody turned up, they're in Spain?
Yes.
What sort of experience did they have then?
Nice. They've all come back with nice stories and some nice photographs and some videos as well. So the stuff's still being processed and come out in the future. So the guys tend to come back and do a bit of editing and then put something together for us to see.
Excellent. And then, of course, you're very, very busy as a club. Last Sunday, you were at the RSPB Old Moor, I think, for the last Solar Sunday.
Quite successful.
Yeah.
We had quite a few people turn up. We've got members there with different scopes, so there's always something interesting to see. There wasn't as many as they'd hoped, but I think a lot of people are away on holiday.
Yes.
But there's also people looking around the RSPB at the birds as well. But apparently it was a reasonable turnout.
Excellent. And I noticed, earlier on the show, I said you've got an event coming up on the 18th September.
That's an evening one. So that's 5 o'clock, while 7 o'clock. It might run a little bit later. We should be doing a talk, and we'll also have telescopes out to show people things.
You just need the weather, don't you?
Yeah, I think there's a bat walk as well around the area at RSPB, and there might be birds roosting as well.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. So
it's usually a good place to visit, RSPB Old Moor.
Now,
and there's a cafe there as well.
Are we allowed to talk about, because it's been non-stop, hasn't it? Are we allowed to talk about, you had a very special visit to your observatory on the 25th of August, was it a Tuesday?
Yeah. It's been a bit hush-hush.
Oh!
It's been a bit hush-hush, but the observatory at Hoover's going to be on Sky at night. We can't release any photographs or too much information because we've been sworn to strict secrecy so that the programme goes out okay.
Wow.
But yes, we had a film crew turn up. So Brian Lawrence visitors, who does the Sky Notes on the Sky at Night. Absolute smashing chap. He's the kind of guy you want as your granddad. and that's the best way to describe him. And he's really well spoken and he's really nice. And I can see why he works for the BBC.
Hey, really, that could be you, Phil. Did they not say, "Come on, come and work for us, Radio Sheffield"? Eh? You know, don't forget where it all started, Phil.
Oh, yes.
You know, before you were famous.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Absolutely.
Will you actually feature then on the show?
Well, he's doing the Sky Notes from the observatory, so they usually go somewhere to do the Sky Notes. So he's doing it. It's in the daytime. They was there around lunchtime. So it'll be like midday coverage. So he brought his notes. So it'll be like the Sky Notes for the rest of the month.
Oh, and how did they find out about your club then?
Well, they'll know. Sky Night will know clubs in the country. And plus the fact there's a list. If you there's a list for all amateur astronomy societies in the club in the country. So you can look them up on there. But then there's also social media. If you go on Facebook and type in astronomy societies, there's Manchester, Durham, Cleveland, they're all over the place, Liverpool, all over.
So is that something...
They've all got Facebook pages now, so you can look them up. And
so do the Sky at Night, is that something they do regularly then, go around to local clubs to give it that context?
I think they're trying to. Well, the other thing is they've had to cut their programmes down. They're only doing 8 programmes a year now due to BBC COVID. And they told us that actually the BBC Sky at Night doesn't cost that much to actually produce and run. So it's just a shame that they were unhappy the fact that they only got 8 shows a year.
Would that normally be 12?
Yes, it used to be 12 a year, but I think they've only been doing 8 for the past couple of years.
Wow, that's quite an honour. But then when that show does go out... For your club, as a profile of your club, you'll become a bit more up there, won't you?
I hope so. It'd be nice. They were very impressed with our gear.
Were they?
They were very impressed with what the setup we've got. So, I mean, we've got not only got a really good telescope and observatory, we've got a really good dome. It's a 5-metre dome, which is impressive, to be honest. And it's steel. And it's a proper constructed observatory. We've got a toilet facilities, disabled access, we've got a kitchen workshop, and we've also got a lecture suite in there as well. So we've got our own grounds, we've got a car park, we've got electric, we've got telephone, water, we've got it all. So we've got a good facility, and it's growing all the time. We don't just stand still. It's like, well, what we're going to do next, and how we're going to develop things, and what we're going to do. So it's not just like built and forgotten about. It's like an ongoing project.
Amazing. You need to get them to go to your house, Phil, and see what you're building.
Yeah, well, I've actually only just finished constructing my dome yesterday. I put the skirt on the dome yesterday and sealed it and gave it a coat of paint.
Oh.
Now got to resin finish it so it's completely watertight. I'm just a bit concerned about the weather. We had a thunderstorm yesterday. I covered it over with a tarpaulin just to make sure I didn't get any water in. But I'd like to resin it this weekend just to make sure that water cannot get in. But I've built a slide in. There's like a slit in the middle so the dome door slides backwards. So I've got an opening that I can adjust as well. So our observatory at Huber opens sideways so the two doors open so the slit's down the middle. Well, the one I've got now, the door slides backwards and I've got a flap that drops down at the front, so I've got different apertures to look out of. I've done this really to avoid street lighting, so I've got a baffle up to keep the street lighting out, and my idea is when I've got the telescope in the dome, the actual dome will actually protect it from light as well. So I'm going to keep the frost off and the wind off, sound out, and light out as well. So it should improve this year's observing.
Amazing, because you are coming up to the time of year you said that you look forward to.
Yes, well, 10 o'clock, it's like you can start doing stuff. So last night I got my gear out at 10 o'clock. I managed to do a couple of photographs, got a Dumbbell Nebula and a star cloud in Cygnus, and that was about 10:30, 11 o'clock. So I don't have to stop up while 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, which has been really impacting me, me head, because I've been having a been having at the Expo.
Well, it's the stress. I think it's the stress of being famous, Phil. I do, honestly.
It could be.
You know, yeah. It's like a rock band, isn't it? They want to be famous, and then all of a sudden, they're famous. It's like, whoa.
When do they sleep?
Exactly.
It's difficult. And then you've got a full-time job as well.
Well, you know the answer to that, Phil. Look at your pension statement. go and see South Yorkshire Pensions and say, look, what am I worth, mate? Brilliant. But yeah. Paul's asking me, is that the last solar eclipse until 2090? Isn't, is it? But it's...
No, there's another one next year.
Yeah.
But it won't be as big as the one. Like I said, they happen every year. Sometimes first thing in the morning, sometimes last thing at night. And they might be going round the globe when they start or finish. So it's difficult to see them at the best. But I think it's going through North Africa and Egypt. So I believe the best place to see it next year is in Egypt when it's totality. But I think we get a 40%, 50% coverage in the UK. So, I mean, that's not bad. It's worth watching. But get some proper equipment between now
exactly.
and
then. Exactly. A cereal box and a pinhole. That's what
we
want.
And you can buy solar viewing glasses on Amazon so you can actually look at the sun. Through solar viewing, and they're only a couple of pounds.
Yeah,
cardboard with some film, and you'll be fine. Just do it in advance.
Yeah, so
this is one of the things with astronomy. We know what's going to happen well in advance, and you can prepare, book holidays, go to the right place. You can do all this, no trouble.
But you can't control the weather, Phil.
No,
can you?
No,
you can't. Like when you went to Iceland.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll forget about that then, won't we? And somebody else in your club or somebody you knew at Manvers went the week after you and it were brilliant or something. But no, we were not bitter. So this just in the press, it said you won't have another opportunity, probably in the UK until 2090, to see an eclipse of that clarity, I guess.
Yes. But that's in the UK. But there are other large eclipses like next year. But to be honest, a 50% coverage is impressive to watch.
Yeah. Right, and on that note, we're going to let you go, Phil, because you're going to join us next Saturday as well, I think,
yes,
and
I'll
talk about
Eye
on the Sky. Have you any idea when Sky at Night's going to be broadcast, your episode?
I think it's about 2 weeks away.
Oh, my God. So keep us posted then.
I think it's on, is it BBC 4?
I'm sure it'll be all over your pages. Brilliant, Phil. Enjoy the rest of your bank holiday weekend.
Thank
and I hope it doesn't rain. Bye-bye.
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 Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.